go.
Sniper arrow on the guard.
It strikes true. The guard drops.
I move to the doorway. Detect traps.
None detected.
I enter.
Left flank.
Right.
One hobgoblin facing east.
Backstab.
Double damage. Critical hit. He's dead. Footsteps behind the door to the north.
I notch two arrows.
I climb the walls to get above the door.
Five goblins enter from the north.
I fire.
Both arrows hit.
Cleave.
You kill one and wound another.
I drop on the last one and grapple.
You got hold of him.
This one is for Crouton.
With his dying breath, he utters,
"The Dark Lord will kill you all."
Wait, these things can talk? I want two taken alive. I want to try something.
Welcome to Let's Roll, the show where we discuss various role-playing games with guests and fellow tabletop gamers. I'm Siskoid, and today we're looking at Victory Games' James Bond 007 RPG, a classic, some might agree, and among them is my guest, Ryan Blake. Had to go with a Brit on this one. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Hi, thank you for inviting me as the token Brit.
Token Brit. And as a token Brit, you might have a very different history with James Bond than we do over here. I mean, obviously he's a cultural icon internationally, but what is it for a British person?
Well, I think for most British people, before Daniel Craig came along, it was the inevitable film that was on over the Christmas period. You could not escape James Bond, perhaps even multiple James Bonds, although my childhood seems to be punctuated with endless repeats of Octopussy for some reason. I don't know why. But over the Christmas period, James Bond was a Sunday evening, Sunday afternoon film kind of piece of iconography. That's what James Bond is for a lot of British people.
I've seen them all, obviously. You know, it's like you get through a phase where there's so many at some point that you just want to see. What was your first one?
It probably was Octopussy, because that was early 80s when I was a kid. But the first one I saw in the cinema was definitely GoldenEye. I remember that very clearly. Mm-hmm. It was Octopussy or Live and Let Die. They kind of blend into one for me because they were on, it feels like they were on every Sunday. So, yeah. So it's one of those two.
Yeah, I think my very, very first experience was whatever that teaser. I don't even remember which film it is, but the teaser where Blofeld is thrown into a smokestack.
That's Live and Let Die.
That is not Live and Let Die.
I thought that was Roger Moore's first one where he...
Yeah, I think it only happens in For Your Eyes Only. Anyway, I always mix those elements up because it's like the teaser isn't necessarily part of the story. But Live and Let Die was my first full-on, I think. Or maybe my first one was in class, because in ninth grade, we had this teacher who wanted us to write like movie reports. Like, you know, it's a lazy day. He's going to put a movie in. In English class, and he would only pick like these bro movies, like Octopussy and A View to a Kill, and then like Missing in Action Part 2, you know, stuff like that. There wasn't a lot of variety. He liked action films, I guess.
Wow, Missing in Action Part 2, holy smokes.
Yeah, that was the first one he ever showed. But I remember Octopussy and maybe A View to a Kill were shown in this class. So, and maybe A View to a Kill I saw later. You know, it's possible that I'm mixing up memories, because depending on what was on VHS at the time.
Yeah.
do you have a favorite Bond?
Well, here's the thing. Just going back just quickly, because for me, Roger Moore is broken up more into moments than films. And the teaser part you were talking about, where he drops the unnamed Blofeld into a chimney stack, is a knock because of the Rights of Spectre.
Right.
And that actually will come up later on in our discussion of the system, because
correct,
a similar thing was affected by it. My favorite James Bond film, just as a piece of entertainment, as opposed to being, you know, classic Bond, is License to Kill. I've got this
really
very, I don't know what it is. There's something about that film that I really liked. Now, maybe it was because it was Bond breaking the formula and I really liked that. After that, it's Casino Royale, but I think that's like so many people's favorite now. If I could only watch one, just as pure entertainment, it's License to Kill. I really liked everything about Timothy Dalton's Bond, except for his accent.
Okay. So is he your favorite Bond as a performer?
Is it pretentious if I say my favorite Bond is the Bond from the novels? Because that is really my favorite Bond overall. If I was, like I said, if I'm going to watch the films, I like Timothy Dalton is probably my favorite Bond, because they tried to do the proper Bond early and it all fell apart. And then it became Pierce Brosnan. And it wasn't until we got Daniel Craig that we got close to it again. So,
right.
So film wise, it's Dalton. Overall, it's the novels Bond.
Okay. Well, I would agree with that assessment. And like the Bonds that the takes on Bond that I appreciate more, perhaps as an adult, are the ones that are closer to the books, like Daniel Craig, like Timothy Dalton, who really suffered from, I think, less than stellar stories. I think like the movies weren't that great, but I think he was great in the part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Early on, I think in Her Majesty's Secret Service, even though it has the off Bond, if you will, you know, George Lazenby is still like, oh, I feel like there's more spycraft in that one. And I like those elements. So, okay, well, that's sort of our Bond history. What about the game? Is this a game that you played or ran? What is your history with it?
Well, I've never actually played it. I've GM'd it a few times. Okay. This system was like 83 to 87. And I didn't get it until afterwards. And so I got it in the kind of, not interregnum period exactly, but when Timothy Dalton was Bond. And so I was in high school. And so Bond wasn't cool in high school. So I had to hunt for players because I still really loved Bond and I was the only person I knew who'd read some of the books. So I got the system after it had already been cancelled, but it was still available in certain RPG shops. That's how I came to it. And also at the time, I was very heavily into Torg, the first edition of Torg.
Sure.
And I found out that the guy who wrote the James Bond system, his assistant, if that's not a demeaning term, Greg Gordon, had actually designed a huge amount of Torg. So, and I loved that system. So I went back and I saw it. It's sort of, you know, it's in a pupae form. So I really, really enjoyed it. And we were just getting to the sort of like the World of Darkness was everywhere and all that stuff. And I was so sick of the World of Darkness, nothing against it. But because I love Bond, I devoured it and I sort of tried to hunt down everything I could for it. And I didn't get everything because there were like 16 supplements by that stage and like a half PDF one, which would come out years later. But I really loved it. And I loved the sort of old school out of it. So I GM'd it. And the good thing about it is, and we'll probably discuss this more, it's really designed for one-to-one role playing. So that made it much more interesting. And you could concentrate on one character. So in that respect, if you're not into, or if you don't require a group and you want to stick to the genre, this is a great system for that. So I really enjoyed that, having one-to-one sessions.
Yeah, we'll certainly talk about, you know, our options in terms of, it's a little bit like the Doctor Who role-playing game in a way, you know, it could be asymmetrical where, you know, if you want to play a 007, they don't really hang out together, you know, so we'll talk about those options. For me, I've run maybe three of the adventures of the, you know, prefab adventures with a group of players, probably four around the table or something. So I did not play it one-on-one or anything. I feel it evokes a lot of the feeling of the sort of cinematic espionage rather than, you know, if you want to go gritty and real espionage, there are other options. But this one is, you know, action film first in a way. But it hits on all the things that you expect from the James Bond genre, especially the movie genre. I've never run a full campaign with ongoing agents. They were all one shots. But I was toying with an idea for, I called it Bond's Bastards, where every player would play an illegitimate child of James Bond. Like in the modern era, every player would pick a mom or somebody, you know, it's like, well, he slept with Pussy Galore, so that's my mom. And then maybe fashion their character around that character's skill sets type. You know, it's like he's really his mother's son or daughter. I toyed with it. I talked to people about it. It was a possibility for a while, but then we went another way and we never played it. But I still have that in my back pocket. Okay, let's talk about the game. What is the premise of it all? Let me just give you a short Wikipedia-style explanation. The full title is James Bond 007, Role-Playing in Her Majesty's Secret Service. It's an espionage game based on the James Bond books and films. It was designed by Gerard Christopher Klug and was published by Victory Games, a subsidiary of Avalon Hill. The game and its supplements were published, like you said, from 1983 to 1987, at which point the license lapsed. And according to sources, it was at the time the most popular espionage role-playing game, bumping Top Secret off its perch. at the 1984 Origins Award. It won H.G. Wells Award for the Best Role-Playing Rules of 1983. It was licensed from both the film's license holder and the book's license holder, but that still didn't give it the rights to Blofeld and Spectre. That is a complicated issue. So there's a similar organization in the game called Tarot or Tarot, led by Carl Fenric Scorpios, but I'm sure players replaced it with the actual, with Spectre and the actual names in the game, probably. And obviously, you play MI6 agents during the Cold War with high-octane, jet-setting, crazy gadget action and romantic notions about spies. I think it's more broccoli than Le Carré. Let's put it that way. Character generation. So you hit upon the big question, really. Like, obviously, you could play Bond himself and his best known allies, you know, the stats are in there. But would you? Maybe for a one shot, you might, you know, but usually players like to invent their own characters. And while I said MI6, obviously you could center the game around the CIA or some other service, you know, from your own country, maybe. But would you? It's kind of the question. Do you play just the one agent? Do you play a team of agents, which I would call Mission Impossible style? You know, they would still be highly competent, but not super heroic. You could also play rookies. I don't see the point of that. But in your experience, are there problems with playing it with more than the one-on-one?
When you watch a James Bond film, you're watching James Bond doing his thing. He might occasionally have Felix Leiter come in to give him some backup. Great. And he will talk to lots of people. He'll know people. But It's not an ensemble piece. That's why when there's somebody else in the film that stands out, like Vesper Lynn in Casino Royale, you notice them.
Right.
So Jinx. Jinx. Yeah, exactly. Who very nearly was her own franchise. I have not met anybody in the role-playing world who would come to James Bond and think, yeah, let's form a group. Because you go to that, you know, you'd want the Mission Impossible RPG, like you said, for that. And the system reflects this somewhat. There are three levels. You can be a rookie, you can be an agent, or 00. It's set up more for elite characters. You don't come into that. You can play, obviously, a rookie and an agent. But when you're watching James Bond, you want, as Roger Moore put it, he's not just a jack of all trades. He's a master of them. So playing a low powered character in the James Bond RPG is a license to get killed more than anything else. I love this system, but I'll be very interested to hear how you played it as a group. If they're all playing 00s, which is kind of out of character for them anyway, you've got four elite characters, and it's a bit of a sort of a min-max thing. You know, there's nothing that should stop them marching through the villains to some extent. You'd have to make the villains so powerful. So it's an interesting conundrum to have. But like I said, I've only GM'd this solo because when I said, do you want to play the James Bond RPG? Nobody wanted to play it in a group. So
right.
It's an interesting dilemma.
Yeah. For me, it was just normal in the game. You build your character with points. You know, it's like if you're a 00, you start with, or generation points. There are many kinds of points in this thing.
Yeah,
but very old school in that way. But you have 9,000 generation points if you're a 00. 6,000 generation points to play with if you're an elite agent, what I would call a specialist. Because then I feel like when you're in a group, what you would do is, maybe we got a weapons expert, a vehicle expert, a charmer, con man, seduction expert, you know. So if people specialize, instead of being a master of all trades, they're masters of their trade. And so they have a role to play in any given adventure. Like it's like dividing James Bond into four. And if you're a rookie, you only have 3,000 generation points to play with. A 00 is three times as useful, powerful as a rookie agent. I think the rookie agents are in there because traditional role-playing games are very much about leveling up.
Yeah.
And this is one of the first games, really. I mean, this and like, I feel like it's a lot like a superhero game. Superhero games, yes, there is some improvement that you can bring to your characters, but generally it should be made with the points you need for that moment, for that style of play. And Superman is always going to be Superman. Like, nobody's going to go through the game starting, well, I'll be Superman in the Golden Age and then play for 80 years until I can push planets around. You know, that's not, when you create a superhero, and I think James Bond is comparable to a superhero.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're creating a character that is already hyper competent, and the game is not about you leveling up or improving. That's not what it's about. And I think for 1983, wow, that's very early to come to that conclusion. Not a lot of games, successful games, were doing that. Most games were going by the Dungeons & Dragons template where you start low and build up over years of play. That was sort of the thing. With James Bond, it seems very obvious from the beginning that you can already play the top-level character and that you don't need a party. You can play one-on-one, which is also unusual. And the way the adventures are packaged, it kind of really encourages one-shots. Let's just play this one mission. Boom. It's done. You know, you're not going to have James Bond traveling through the country and having adventures along the way and improving, you know. So it's very close to the source material, but it's very far from what role-playing games were doing in the early 80s.
Yeah, you do start with a fully realized, been there, done that. You could have them be world weary, and very much the finished article is what you start with. And so it's all about immersing yourself in the genre. Well, and being James Bond. You're not there to be better than Bond. You're there to be James Bond. So it absolutely fits. And interesting, you were saying about Bond being like a superhero, the origins of the DC Heroes game, which I know you have a passing fancy for, are also found by the same creator here, Greg Gordon. So it does kind of fit in that fashion.
I think there are many places where this game intersects other games. You mentioned Torg earlier. We'll talk about some mechanics that were adapted for Torg. I feel like this was the precursor of some of those mechanics. When you look at the surface of it, building a character, it's pretty standard. You've got strength, dexterity, willpower, perception, and intelligence scores between 5 and 15. You're buying them with generation points, just like you do skill levels. And also some physical aspects, like height and weight and appearance. For example, it costs more to be nondescript. If you're a distinctive agent, well, you might gain fame points. I said there were many points. Fame points that make the villains notice you. So we'll talk about this more in the game mechanics section. Money is actually not an issue in this game. Unlimited funds, black credit cards, you know. And then you can also add weaknesses or disadvantages optionally to give yourself more generation points. So like Bond has an attraction to the members of the opposite sex, a sort of weakness, for example. So you can also get more gen points by making the character an expert in a field, making them older. They could start with more fame points because they're well known. There are ways to modify your agent and not have it be necessarily exactly James Bond or his allies. When you played, was it James Bond? Like your one solo player, was he playing James Bond or was he like
005? We had one with Bond to sort of get used to the system.
Sure.
And then we had a couple. He wanted to be 0000. He thought that was hilarious. but yeah, I think he ended up being 0023. And the idea was, we sort of took the premise that in all of the Bond films, there's nearly always a mention of a previous 00 being killed. We decided, well, instead of just replacing them with, you know, we've got a new 006 or whatever,
right,
they would just add a new number for filing purposes. We were both civil servants at the time, so it was a kind of like an in-joke of the filing system would be hopeless. So they've got to keep adding numbers. So eventually we end up with 002007 because there have been so many agents killed because they're all such high-risk assets. So, yeah, so we started off with that. And the key difference, I remember this very distinctly, the key difference was this was an agent who would seduce women but would never sleep with them. So there were a lot of sexually frustrated Bond girls in the adventures that we played. Because he had a really high seduction skill, but he refused point blank to ever sleep with them. He just didn't want to be Bond. He thought he hasn't got time to be sleeping with women because, you know, Dr. Heidenreich von Hitler has got a 90 megawatt laser pointed at the moon. He can't afford to take the time to have sex with this woman. He's got to stop that from happening.
Right.
So he was a very sort of, it was a very practical James Bond idea, but just with that crucial element taken out, he was very much must complete the mission first. So
I think it fits the whole idea that attraction to members of the opposite sex was a weakness on the character sheet. So in other words, Bond was wasting time. Bond was kind of failing, falling into a weakness. You might look at James Bond and say, well, he gets all the ladies, that's a strength. But if he's wasting valuable time or these women are actually going to betray him, which happens in some of the stories. So when you look at it that way, then if a character doesn't have that, well, that gives them other options, you know. In terms of game mechanics, all right, so dice rolls, combats, you know, all of that. This uses 6 and 10-sided dice. Most rolls are made with percentile dice against a success chance on a table to get a quality rating. You roll under this number to get at least an acceptable success up to an excellent success. So the degree of success is right there in the one roll. So you don't roll damage You know, just it's like, oh, an excellent gunshot that gives you more damage than an adequate, or what is it, acceptable success.
Acceptable, yeah.
Yeah. And this, like, we're Doctor Who RPG players. That also has a scaled success result type element. I feel like this is kind of, in 1983, this is cutting edge.
Yeah, this game was well ahead of its time with its subsystems and as you said, its levels of success. I really enjoyed it, and we'll come to this more in a minute when we talk about ease factors, but I loved the fact that you could have potentially a 300% chance of success on a percentile roll, which sounds completely counterintuitive, but when you think about it, a lot of what Bond does is not just his action, but him doing it with style and mm-hmm. succeeding extremely well. I always think back to the Moonraker bit where he's in that, the heavy gravity spinner. I've completely forgotten what they call it, the accelerator.
Right, centrifuge thing, yeah.
Yeah, and he's got the wrist dart thing. He has to hit a precise part to stop the device. It's not just a matter of hitting something. He has to hit the right part at the right time as he's going past. So that requires, you know, an excellent result to get away with that. And I like the fact that he incorporated the sort of suaveness of the actions in the films.
Right. There's many elements like that, I feel like, just like for flavor. You mentioned DC Heroes earlier, and the initiative system is very much like DC Heroes, isn't it? You know, characters involved in a chase or a combat, they declare their actions in reverse order of speed, which is 1 to 3 in this, based on the sum of perception and dexterity. And these actions are executed in order of speed. So faster characters have the advantage of knowing what the slower characters are going to be doing, because they're kind of doing it slowly as you're reacting, right? And this is a DC Heroes thing. Is also counterintuitive in a way. It's like, well, it's your turn, do your action. No, I've got to tell people what my action is going to be, and then it only resolves later. This game also has that. And speed also affects how many attacks a character may make in a round. You know, so your hyper-competent character can take on alone a number of goons, you know, no problem.
A very good bit of immersive genre structure for this game, because Bond is never particularly physically fast in any of the films. I mean, this is not wushu or anything like that. He's a fairly standard punch kick kind of a fighter. But because he has this ability, he's very fast mentally. It's like he has the illusion of being super fast. One of the skills in this is Sixth Sense, and that's James Bond's kind of ineffable ability to scope out a situation. And as you said, he can get past a whole bunch of goons, but it's not like the guy's Bruce Lee. It's because he has this ability, you know, he's fast. It's like all the goons have to declare what they're doing first, so Bond can, like, you know, saunter one way, saunter the other way, nonchalantly dodge the punches and take them out. So it's, again, it's a really good mechanic. This is, for me anyway, definitely the first game. Actually, I kind of got it at the same time as DC Heroes, but it's the first game I remember thinking, this is really clued in to what it's trying to do, because I'd played D&D sparingly and Warhammer Fantasy and all that, and it was the same kind of kill, XP, level up, but there was nothing about it that was really stand out. Whereas with James Bond, it's like, I'm in a James Bond movie. Even the players picked up on that from the rule system, because most of the players I know don't GM, but even they picked up on it just from the way they were rolling the dice and everything.
To me, genre emulation is an important part, especially of licensed games. You want it to be like the source material, you know? And another thing that's like DC Heroes, and I got to say, like, DC Heroes came 2 years later. Okay, so this is really a precursor, but it's got hero points.
Yeah, bizarrely named, I always felt, in James Bond.
I never felt
of James Bond as a hero.
Like double O points or something, you know.
Yeah,
that would have been too many numbers, I don't know. But it allows characters to perform cinematic stunts, and characters earn a hero point every time they get a quality one result on a skill other than combat. So that encourages other solutions. I like that, other than just combat. And when the GM chooses to award one for, you know, clever or dramatic action, obviously. And the hero point can change the quality rating of any result by one level. So I love this, because, like, you could just do the standard thing, but if you put a little spin on it, if you put a little, it's harder, it's more stunt work, it's crazier, it's more cinematic, it's cooler, I guess, would be the James Bond thing, right? It's cooler to do it with more difficulty, But you can reduce that difficulty with your hero points. So in other words, what's something that is impossible, you know, like that trick shot is completely impossible to a normal person, it becomes possible for your 00 agent, and just by spending hero points on it. So, and you can also use hero points to, you know, change your environment, say, well, isn't there a beaker of acid right there? You know, you can do stuff like that, which you can also do in DC Heroes, but obviously this predates that. And I feel whatever we think of the name, the exact name for this, it is still a great mechanic for a cinematic action game.
Yeah, I always felt, like you said, if they'd called them 00 points, then the abbreviation would have been OOPS, which I felt was, you know, so beautifully understated for James Bond, who never says OOPS.
But I think the villains have something like, the villains don't have villain points. They have survival points.
Yeah, survival points. Yeah,
so yeah. That's an interesting notion as well. You can keep Goldfinger alive to the end of the adventure, basically. You know, it's like you don't want a catastrophic failure for your villains because you kind of need them. Whereas I think the agents can be very powerful and could resolve the plot with a well-aimed bullet too early in the story.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's a cool thing, but they're still not called villain points. Maybe hero points is the one that they should have changed to something. Maybe action points, I think, would have been great.
Yeah, yeah.
Action,
yeah.
Survival, more of a mirror.
I guess in the 80s, you've got to remember, though, that this was sort of like pre-revisionism on Bond. And so Bond was just, I suppose, from 83 to 87, when it was Roger Moore and it was a bit more campy. Mm-hmm. He was still considered a hero. No one sort of questioned that he's, you know, working for the status quo, and maybe some of the villains had a point, and all that stuff was not to come for years yet. So I guess that was probably more fitting at the time.
You know, it's a job. He's ruthless about it. And he's not really questioning the merits of the mission, do the mission, you know, especially Roger Moore, who felt like James Bond should be a hero and, you know, on set would refuse to do certain things or say certain things that he felt went against that. It makes sense for the portrayal of the game at that point, but obviously players can go in different ways. So I like that there's a mechanic to balance that out, to balance the impulse of players who have been groomed by Dungeons and Dragons to kill every threatened sight. You can't just walk into the Casino Royale and shoot Le Chiffre and it's done type of thing, you know?
I've had players who would definitely have tried that if not for the sort of balance of the system, believe me. So you're absolutely right that you cannot go at the problems head on in a James Bond, movie or RPG.
There's got to be a lot of investigation anyway. So you very often you can't just shoot your way through a thing because, first of all, in this game, you also have the stuff with the fame points, you know, so you're encouraged to use subterfuge to keep your character's actions as covert as possible, including minimizing acts of deadly violence, because killing an opponent results in fame points, which is a penalty. It brings the agent closer to becoming too well known, and you can lose your character. According to the game, you could lose your character for this, right? Because like you have to retire Bond. I feel like maybe Bond should have been retired a long time ago, according to these rules.
Yeah, that was when I read those rules. I was just thinking, everyone knows it's James Bond every time. How is he usable? It didn't make any sense to me. I thought that was hilarious. Talking about the fame points, mm-hmm. This is the only system I know where it's actually statistically advantageous to play a female character, because they actually get a fame point reduction because the secret services in this game, MI6 and what have you, and most agencies, full stop, have fewer female operatives.
Okay, so it's they get underestimated. They expect a man to show up.
Exactly, right. Exactly. They also get a bonus when using the seduction mechanics. I don't know if you saw that in the rules, but in one way, the system was very enlightened in that sense, and also very backwards, because they get seduction techniques because they are physically hot. That's it. That's the entire rule.
But they would be in the movie, right?
Oh, yeah,
and absolutely. A lot of female agents, for real, were used in that particular role, even in real history, Mata Hari and, you know, going back. And we're talking about a game in the 80s, which is emulating a movie franchise and a book series from the 60s on.
Yeah.
And James Bond is a sexist character, has been a sexist character. So that's kind of in the game, you know, obviously tweak as you wish. It's not too bad, you know, when you read it. It is still that world, and it plays with that. Like, the seduction is a skill. And I think it's a fun mechanic, and that this is where it's a bit Torg, right? Because you have to complete various steps, the look the opening line, the witty conversation, beginning intimacies, and the when and where. Ooh la la. So, warm coffee. So there's like these steps, which are not like if you don't want to roleplay it, really, basically, or if you want to add a, well, here's how the NPC reacts to your look, opening line, etc. Are they attracted at any point? Do they fall for your agent, essentially, and how hard? Because there are various levels of success, right? But this is like Torg has this, they call it dramatic skill resolution, where certain tasks in Torg, the basic example is defusing a bomb. Well, defusing a bomb, there's a ticking clock. You have so much time to do it. There are many steps. It's not just one roll and it's done, because that doesn't emulate what the ticking clock bomb about to go off thing is, right? That's not how it feels in a movie. So by giving it the several steps, and you can't fail any of these steps, and you have so much time to complete the steps, then you create a dramatic skill resolution element, which is an interesting mechanic that can be used and morphed into different ways to do different things in Torg anyways, which I'm playing right now. So I really have it in mind, but Seduction here works in the same way. Each of these steps must be gone through, and maybe you don't have to do the awkward GM to player flirting too much. Yeah. Let's just roll for it. But so it's not just, hey, I give this person a look, roll on Seduction, and it's done. You know, you get to play it out because the movies do.
Yeah, when I was running this, I found that the player wanted to do the opening line so they could just do a cheesy opening line just for fun. But then after that, it was two guys in a room, mm-hmm. both of whom were, you know, heterosexual. And so he just didn't want to do the rest of it. And I was like, I've never actually been a woman who's been seduced before, so I'm not sure how I would do that as a GM. So the system really helps out with situations like that. And not everybody who roleplays is a born seducer of women or men. So it really helps giving those steps and giving it the flavor without having to be very didactic with, well, now you roleplay your furtive look. Now give me your opening line, et cetera, et cetera. So great system. I like the fact that it was called social combat, and social combat covers persuasion, seduction, and our old favorite, torture, which I thought was a very unique way of looking at it, that torture is a form of social combat.
Obviously, the villains torture people, but also Bond has tortured people. It's like it was a main feature of a show like 24, where a hero can go and torture to get vital information. So if you want to go a little bit darker with this material, you can.
The example bit of play they give you in the book is the laser scene from Goldfinger, you know, do you expect me to talk? That bit. Mm-hmm. And they show you the mechanics of that and how that social interaction works. And it was a really good illustration. So I just wanted to sort of point that out, that they give you bits from the films and show how the rules work with them, which I think was really, really good.
It's very easy to visualize. It's been visualized for you, right? So fans of James Bond can look at the films for inspiration, understanding of what's going on. I think that's it's well done. One system that was really praised at the time is the one for chases, because they add a bidding step. You're fleeing and pursuing sides, bid, with the winning bidder getting to choose whether to try to close or widen the gap first or last. But all sides must make the roll at the resulting ease factor. So I said a lot of words there, but you did provide an example of this. I opened this up and we might show how the mechanic works in this case. So I'm reading from your chase example, because chases are not an easy thing to do in role-playing games, to make them exciting or interesting, right? That's one of the things that many systems have tried. Chases, dogfights, you know, there are certain things that don't translate as well. Martial arts, it's important to note when a system really does it well. In this case, according to your example, I'll play the GM in this. And the GM is running a boat chase along the Nile River in Egypt. James Bond has just rescued Q from an organization, supremely hostile, antagonistic, terror, nautically evil regime, Shatner. Is this from a real game, Ryan?
Yeah. I don't like William Shatner. And I just had a moment where I just thought, I need an organization, but this one is going to be set involving the ocean.
Okay.
And the acronym just sort of sprung into my head. So, yeah.
All right. And Shatner was seeking to extract him, Q, for his knowledge of a satellite tracking system he designed. James has a 17 skill in boating and is being chased by a henchwoman known as Joanna Poker, who has a cover as a stuntwoman in a high-profile Hollywood movies. Joanna Poker has a boating skill of 21. James has, so she's better. James has the initiative and calls that he wants to draw away from Joanna Poker by trying to outrun her. So let's get in the scene. Pulling away, ease factor starts at 8. Do you want to make it tougher?
Thinking that an ease factor of 8 would give him a chance of 136% to succeed, no, I'll pass.
Well, Joanna Poker fears no man. She bids 6.
6 puts him at 102%. Still a likely success, as any roll of 100 is a failure. Really, she is as feisty as she is deadly, so I will play the game. How about we go 5 and make things interesting? 5 gives James an 85% chance here, and it is a risk, but he wants to own this chase.
Joanna Poker's chance is still above 100% at 105% right now. The GM wants to alert James. She is not some hood, so she pushes it a little more. 5! You can almost hear the laughter across the water. She bids 4.
Not showing it, but he is nervous now. Ease factor 4 puts him at 68%, and that is no guaranteed situation. If he stops now, he rolls his test at ease factor 5. Okay, he laughs, trying to act confident. That little lady, see what she can do.
And as the GM wins, she makes her roll against a success chance of 84%. She rolls a 23 on her D100, and that puts her at quality rating 3 success. Following this, James then rolls his D100, looking at 85% or lower. He lucks it and gets an 84 on his roll, putting him at a quality rating of 4. So, looks like Joanna Poker is not just a pretty face. As you power up, she matches you easily and gets a little closer to you as she fakes you into a corner of the river thick with crocodiles replete with fusion dentures. What you're actually bidding is the ease factor going to multiply your chances of success, right? That's
you are basically saying, I will take the chance of making what I'm doing much harder, and if I pull this off, I win. And it's who blinks first. It uses also the psychology of James Bond, and it's all flavor. There is the mechanical role at the end, obviously, but it's all flavor. You don't worry about top speed of vehicles or durability of vehicles or anything like that at all. It's literally all flavor. It's like being in a James Bond chase in whatever vehicle you're in. It's fantastic. I love this system. It's my favorite bit of the game, actually.
And it's also the fact that you are bidding goes into all those casino scenes, you know? It's like there's a gambling element. There's a maybe even a little bit of bluffing element. So it puts you in mind of James Bond and his world, you know, without it being about that. You know, there's no gambling in a chase, but by bringing a gambling element, a bidding element in one of the subsystems, you sort of have that going for you as well.
Were you ever encouraged to learn any of the card game rules? Because there's an extensive subsystem on how to play the various card games of James Bond in
right,
this game.
Right, right, right. I think maybe one of those adventures had a had. They looked at the films and books and what's in there and how do we translate it into systems for this game? Because most games at the time obviously did not have those subsystems. You know, you're not expected to have casino action in a D&D game, or you could in a Traveler game, or you could in a D&D game. You can have casinos, obviously, but that's not the focus. And by giving these things a subsystem, they're saying it can be the focus of a scene, of a sequence, and we want to treat it that way. Not just as a one-off role that just fits into a larger system, but have it be its own thing and have its own excitement.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's all the flavor and all the fun. You don't need to learn how to play Baccarat to play Baccarat in the game, which is great. We actually had a golf sequence. It was Goldfinger. Yeah, Goldfinger and Moonraker both have got golf sequences. And I wanted to see if it would work with golf. Now, I can't stand golf in real life. Good luck if you enjoy it, but I can't stand it. And we played golf using the system in this. And actually, we just played 9 holes because, you know, we didn't want that to be the game. But it got so tense by the 9th hole. It really genuinely got really tense because the agent had to win for various reasons and what have you. Anything that can make golf appear interesting or fun, that's a winner for me. I mean, that's some kind of weird alchemy. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, you're sort of leading us into the next section where we talk about adventures. And I want to talk about the products, obviously, but also memories of play. Most adventures that were produced for this game were based on a specific James Bond movie or book with a few vital plot details changed. So players who'd seen the films would still be surprised. So we had Goldfinger and Octopussy and You Only Live Twice and A View to a Kill, etc. A couple were written as sequels to earlier adventures. Mm. So there was like a Goldfinger 2, for example. I don't want to spoil necessarily the changes in these adventures in case people do find them. But the types of changes were like maybe in the actual movie, there's an ambiguity at first as to who is the actual villain. And then the game adventure will change that. So the person who you think might be the villain isn't exactly the villain, or the twist in the movie is a different twist in the adventure, or a set piece that was in a villain's lair is now taking place on an island somewhere in the outdoors. You know, so the more you went, the more things probably changed, but I think you had the same sequences. So Live and Let Die, for example, is a good one. You still had, for example, that boat chase in the bayou. You know, that's still in there. No matter what, you still, you know, wreck a wedding, whatever. That's still there. But how it all resolves at the end is completely different. Different action. The identity of Mr. Big is different. So you've got elements like that that are just different enough that the heroes or the players don't know what's going to happen necessarily. They also feel like they're playing out that scenario. You know, they still feel like they're in that particular movie. Was that your experience?
Yeah, there's a sort of semi-famous anecdote about this. I'm sure you know, but just for the listening audience, Eon or whoever it was who owned the James Bond rights, who, you know, the collective name, would often talk to the Victory Games about their scenarios, and they genuinely could not understand why they weren't just using the plot of the films. And Victory Games went back to them and said, well, if we had Goldfinger, the scenario, be like the film, the players would just go to Fort Knox and wait there, and it would be over in 10 seconds. So they had to explain to them why they put these twists on them, why they changed them. But yeah, the idea was, if the scenario is called Goldfinger, the players are probably going to know who the villain is.
Yeah.
So they had to put in these twists. So a lot of the time, in my personal experience, I had most of the scenarios. I would take pieces from each and kind of make like a patchwork Bond movie made of different beats from different films and put them together, because that way the players would not know what's coming. But all of these scenarios, all the ones I've read, all really captured the flavor of the movie. I mean, they really had to construct, what would you say, about 60 to 70% of a whole new Bond film.
Yeah, I mean, based on the same premise with the same villains, I'm sure some are less successful than others. Personally, I played Dr. No, Live and Let Die, and You Only Live Twice. Those are the ones that I personally played, although I'm looking at my shelf there. I've got maybe...
There were 16...
No, there are 11 adventures, really, yeah. And I've managed to find 8. People will say, well, do we really need these adventure products, right? But maybe you want them, regardless, because I'm sure there's a collector's market for these. They're gorgeous. They're not books, they're these gorgeous thin boxes, and they're full of handouts. You got your Before Your Eyes Only envelope, you've got maps, you've got, like, I've gotten some of them through eBay, and sometimes they're already cut up, because sometimes you'll have, like, a color sheet, and there'll be, like, a map, and maybe a diagram, and maybe a memo, a note somebody finds, you know, and they'll have cut them up already, at least the eBay seller put it all back in, you know. Having them physically, instead of some, I don't know, some PDF you might find online, something, you know, because this is long out of print game. If you're playing online, that may be useful to just send images of, you know, maps like Dr. No's Island. But if you're playing in physically, those are great handouts to give people. They're, you know, full colored about this adventure. I think owning them physically for me was one of the things that I really wanted when using these adventures.
It's interesting because I recently acquired the Blade Runner role-playing game.
Sure.
And it very heavily leans on this kind of production value, because you get envelopes with handouts, and I got a nice nostalgia buzz for the James Bond game when I opened it, because they take great care in the same thing. And you're right, this is a game. Now, here's a question I have for you. How intact are your books? Because I found that although the production values and the art were lovely in the James Bond books and box sets and what have you. The actual binding of the books is really bad, like so flimsy.
No, no problems at all. They're very, very solid.
Well, you've obviously have a very deft touch, and you were fortunate enough to get some really good quality ones, because the ones I've got, the glue binding was, it was very 80s binding. It wasn't very solid. So
maybe if I'd used it more, you know, but it hasn't deteriorated. I was flipping through them this week and everything was fine. The most damage I've got is that the thin boxes, when stacked, you know, maybe I stacked other things on top of them and some of them are kind of smushed or were smushed. I think maybe that's the problem. I got them from eBay and they were already, you know, broken boxes. So a few of them are kind of flat, but most of them aren't. And they've got a lot of boxes. I put a lot of boxes on top of them, and they're still fine. So, no, I feel like these, for me anyway, the products stood up to time. What about stories? That, I mean, you had like that, those golf sequences, and you mishmashed everything. So that's really interesting. And I played with a group rather than just the one person. So we had very, very different games probably. I can't tell you that I remember. It's been a while. You know, it was like early 2000s probably. And I don't remember necessarily the moments, you know, how they defeat Dr. No or whatever it is. One of the things I remember I'm going to talk about in GM's advice, so I'll keep that for then. But I always started the adventures with a stunt. I don't care how the adventure really starts. Mm. I want to start it with a stunt.
The cold open.
Yes. It's basically, okay, game opens, characters are, I don't know, already in a fight in a cargo plane with the door open, and when they fall out, they land in their own car and stuff like that. So it's like, oh, you see your car down there. And then, you know, so they drive off and we could play music, you know, the James Bond theme, either on the laptop or whatever I was using at the time. I think I had like a cassette, ka-crunch, yeah. And then you could hear it. And then they're summoned to MI6 headquarters and M gives them a mission and they get the gadgets and whatnot. But I always wanted to start with more of a piece where there's maybe a bit more narration, probably, where rolling isn't as important. The opening stunt. I feel that's how the movies are, right? So I wanted to do that.
Yeah, the cold opening is great because you've got a license to, and I know you very much enjoy, you know, chop socky wushu films. So you can do a crazy stunt that's like maybe from the end of the previous case or is completely disregarded, and you can just go hog wild with whatever it is you're doing. The one I remember is, because obviously I'm a big sci-fi nerd, it was a riff on, I'm gonna forget which one it was. It was a Roger Moore one where he has to jump out of a plane without a parachute, grab hold of somebody with a parachute, take off their parachute, put it on, and he lands on a circus big top. I can't remember which film that was. We started with a space station of some kind. They both had jetpack, two astronauts, but one was the agent. They had jetpacks or whatever the correct term would be, going through Earth's atmosphere, and they had a coolant system on each one that had a big, you know, a big red button on the spacesuit, and they were fighting as they were going through the atmosphere, turning off the other one's cooling system. And every time that happened, there'd be like basically a chase. They would have to get back and reactivate the system. So they were basically alternately burning up or lowering their temperature, and it was a matter of, you know, who could finally turn off the other one so they would burn up and the other one would get into the Earth's atmosphere safely. So it was a very, very high altitude turning off the other one's parachute, effectively, is what it boiled down to. So I think he ended up ripping off the other person's cooling suit button, so the other guy incinerated in the upper atmosphere. I can't remember what the pun was that the guy used. I mean, he was just burning to get me, or it was like really awful, but that was basically the cold open. Had nothing to do with anything else at all. I don't think we ever went near space again, but it was like a really good chase scene / fight in Earth's upper atmosphere. So
I think it's a good way to, first of all, initiate the kind of feeling that you want. Yeah, personally, I would probably make everything a little easier. You know, the ease factor would already be in place, and, you know, death puns or crazy action. This would be a good way to, at the beginning of an adventure, give out hero points. You know, this is just a hero point generator. The cooler you are, the more hero points you generate in this opener, which has nothing to do with anything. When you go into the scenario, you've got a stash that you just created for yourself. And also you trained your mind in that one scene, trained your mind to think like Bond, to think like the high octane action romanticized version of espionage that this is supposed to be. It's like Training Wheels. Even if your players, you know, just like get back into it right away with the start of every adventure, you'd have that moment. And that may be one of the lessons that this game teaches in a way. So let's talk about lessons. We always do. What does this teach us about role-playing?
First off, it gave me an abiding love of genre role-playing. And I think the lesson I got was that, especially with licensed materials, as you said, there is no point doing it and creating a system if you're just going to slap in a generic system. It taught me that subsystems are your friend. That was the first thing, I think, because this is the first game I had that had proper subsystems in that I can remember. And the mechanics have to serve the atmosphere, the genre, the mise-en-scene, whatever you want to call it. And so, you know, rolling percentile is meaningless. But if you're rolling the percentile after bidding in a chase scene that makes it feel like you're actually in the universe you're trying to inhabit, after all, that's the way to go. I think the other lesson is that crunch doesn't mean anything in and of itself. I think this is the game that really taught me, or revealed to me, that I'm not a big fan of crunch for crunch's sake. You know, I don't need a bucket of dice rolls. If one dice roll using an ease factor to make me feel like I'm super cool, playing cards, seducing a woman, getting into a car chase, whatever, that's the key. It's making the players feel like they're in the universe.
Yeah. I couldn't do any better than what you just did. I think that's exactly what this teaches. How also for a GM to always encourage genre emulation in whatever genre you're doing. Because, like, for example, the rules say this stunt would be incredibly difficult, but players can accumulate hero points by being cool and use them to reduce that difficulty of that stunt. So by playing the genre well, you get fuel to simulate the genre even better. And that's a cycle that you want your players to tap into, whatever the game. If what they do is like the genre that you're trying to, like the atmosphere you're trying to, that should make things easier for them to continue doing that or to do that even better. And this game has it hard coded. Okay. Finally, supplements to recommend. Obviously you're going to be finding this on, you know, some sort of illegal PDF storehouses or.
Well, you can get it on Scribd. I found recently.
Okay.
You can get it
okay.
On Scribd,
so there is a place, or else physically. On eBay, obviously, places like that, you know, there is a secondary seller's market for that. Which ones do we want to recommend?
Obviously, there's two ways of getting the main rules. There's the softback book and there's the boxed set, which right. is much nicer. And you get all the handouts.
I have the box. And the box contains the Thrilling Locations source book, which you can also buy separately, obviously. I don't think it's that useful, but it's got good flavor. It's about casinos, hotels, cruise ships, the Orient Express, places of luxury to set your adventures in. But it's a nice bonus. I think in terms of source books, a lot of people are going to like the Q manual. You know, it holds
a
lot of gadgets.
Yeah, that's the gold standard, yeah. But with that, very important to add, I feel, is that if you're buying the game now, the gadgets are hopelessly out of date. So unless you're setting your game in the 80s, yeah, be prepared to be impressed by, you know, 32 megabytes on a wristwatch that can store computer information. It's really out of date, but very nostalgic and wonderful.
If you're going to play Cold War, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The good thing is the rules are all flavor. So you can set it. I mean, you could set it during World War II or you could set it now. The only thing you need to change are the stats. Not the stats. The gadgets are about the only thing you'd need to change and maybe make some new vehicles. But even then, you wouldn't need to really make new vehicles. You just would change the names of them, to be honest. So
yeah,
I just think it's important to know that for anyone potentially looking at this thinking, you can do Daniel Craig with this as well as Sean Connery.
Right. As far as adventures, I know that Dr. No is considered one of the best. I can only say that I enjoyed the three that I did run. So, I have been recommended Goldfinger and The Man with the Golden Gun, but I've been warned away from Goldfinger 2 and A View to a Kill.
Yes.
This is kind of sight unseen. I actually have them. but to say that I really looked through them to see how playable they were, I can't make that claim.
Well, I will say this about A View to a Kill, maybe not running it straight out of the box, as they say, but there's lots of bits in it that are very good. I will say that there's useful stuff in it for a GM. Mm. So other than what you've mentioned, my favorite one, and I admit when I got this, I got it because of the title, because it made me laugh, was just You Only Live Twice 2, Back of Beyond. Just You Only Live Twice 2, fantastic. And that's a solid one. The last supplement they brought out in real time was fittingly on Her Majesty's Secret Service, the film that only had the one-time Bond. So it's I don't know, there's some kind of symmetry there. But that's got four solo adventures in it,
right,
solitaire adventures.
Four little, yeah.
And that's the only one that I remember having scenarios overtly based on the book as well as the film, which appealed to me. Okay. So I did quite like that. I just want to give a shout out to the GM pack, which comes with a GM screen, which I am a sucker for in every game. I always want the GM screen. And that's got cardboard miniatures, which appealed to me again, going back to DC Heroes. I love the cardboard cutout characters. And it's got vehicle standees as well. And it's got charts. The character sheets, here's the thing I didn't realize until I reread it for this. There's no express permission to photocopy the character sheets in the James Bond role-playing game.
Oh, yeah, because many games do that. They give you an express permission to reproduce that for your own needs. So you're an outlaw. You're an outlaw.
You're an outlaw, unless you buy the GM pack or you write very lightly in pencil and rub it out. Yeah, exactly. But I just noticed that. But the GM pack gives you more character sheets. I will say this. You talked about the production value earlier on and the art being very lovely. The James Bond character sheets are so very 80s because they are... How would you put them? They're like official government forms, but in the bad way. They're just numbers and lines. They're not pretty. They're effective. Like James, well, no, I suppose James Bond is pretty in some incarnations, but like James Bond, they're not pretty, but they are effective.
Right. I mean, today people get like these really nice, I say nice, but at the same time, they're kind of hard to print out, you know? So very often they've got a lot of art all around it, so they're draining your ink packs. And in the old days, it was just like white sheet.
Yeah.
Tables and where to put your numbers, and that was it. You know,
I mean, I was surprised they didn't make these look like personnel files from MI6 myself, but...
Anytime I start a game, often, like I'd say 80% of the time, I will be making up my own character sheets for my players. It's going to be... Because all the information that's on character sheets, I don't care about this element. I don't want this on the character sheet. So I would remove those things that, you know, there are other things that I want on the character sheet that are not there, or I feel like character sheets don't leave enough room for certain elements. So I will make modifications myself in any case. So if I were to start up this Bonds Bastards game, I would probably open a Word document and create a new character sheet that was maybe a little more flavorful, but also have a focus on the things that I think are important.
Going back to your Bonds Bastard, have you heard of a comic that is just getting a sequel coming out now called Jimmy's Bastards? It's written by Garth Ennis. You had the idea before him because this is a recent comic, and it is basically about a James Bond stand-in, Jimmy, who had all of these kids around the world with various women when he was a spy, and they're coming after him. They're the villains. It's a different perspective on a similar idea that Jimmy's Bastards are all coming to get him. They're his new Bond villain organization trying to kill their dad for abandoning them. If I could, I would rejig these James Bond sheets to look like MI6 personnel files, because I feel like characters often more invest if their character sheet is at least, you know, partly immersive, partly attractive.
So to finish up on supplements, Postscript. In 2003, Victory Games produced and released a playtest-only adventure module. You mentioned it way at the top of the show. It's based on the book and film From Russia with Love. Planned as an official release in 2004, it really indicates that Victory Games, now under ownership of Wizards of the Coast, you may have heard of them, may have been in negotiations to reacquire the rights to re-release the game and its supplements with new ones planned. Unfortunately, that didn't go anywhere. The module itself has since been reproduced online in PDF format, so you can find it. So what might have been, you know, in time for the Daniel Craig era, I guess, it didn't happen. That was the James Bond 007 RPG. I want to thank my guest, Ryan Blake. Ryan, you have your own role-playing-centric podcast. What can we look forward to?
My podcast, Wibbly Wobbly Dicey YC, the Doctor Who RPG podcast. Still, so far, I think I can safely say we're the only RPG podcast about Doctor Who that isn't an actual play podcast. And coming up, we have an exclusive interview with the game's creator, who is going to explain some of the grey areas about the second edition. We have got a really good podcast coming up with your friend, the Irredeemable Shag, talking about bringing in the 80s science fiction show V into your Doctor Who RPG. We've also got one about The Prisoner. We've got one about historical settings, how to make them authentic. I mean, we've got quite a lot coming up, but those are the next few episodes.
All right. Well, I'll let you go. I'll be back after the break with Game Master advice and your feedback on our previous episode. Thanks again.
Before I go, I would just like to mention something that I know you will appreciate, Siskoid. One of the spin-offs from this system is called Knights Black Agents, which is a Cold War spy game loosely based on this system. Knights Black Agents is derived from a quote, "Good things of day begin to droop and browse, while Knights Black Agents to their praise do rouse." And that's from Macbeth, Act 3, Scene 2. At this point, I feel obliged to point out that Macbeth is Shakespeare's greatest play.
Well,
and how many RPGs are named after Hamlet? Just want to put that out in the air just for people to chew over.
There is a Hamlet RPG. So sort of board game / RPG.
Well, yeah, like Hamlet, it's not one thing or the other. It's wishy-washy, isn't
well,
it?
Well, you know? Maybe I'll talk about it on Hyperion to a Satyr one day.
Thank you very much for having me, Siskoid. Thank you kindly.
Space. The final frontier. These are the recordings of the podcast Gimme That Star Trek. Its ongoing mission, to explore all of Star Trek, to seek out new guests and new opinions, to boldly go where many have gone before.
Gimme That Star Trek. A new episode every month, only at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
If I were Dungeon Master, I'd have it made.
What an interesting proposition. Very well, I shall give you all my power to use as you will.
If your role-playing group hangs out anyway, there is a way to combine the gaming with movie night that I found quite pleasurable. It would seem to work most easily with licensed RPGs like James Bond 007, which is the one I actually did this with, but Doctor Who, Star Trek, Buffy, or else games that have a strong cinematic flavor, like It Came from the Late Late Show or Hong Kong Action Theater. It can, however, still work with games that just have movie analogs, which would include most genres, though perhaps not worlds that are very specific to games. I don't think there are movies that are quite like Spelljammer or Sky Realms of Jeroen, for example. So the trick is pretty simple. On one night of the week, we run the players through a scenario ripped from a movie. Later that week, it could conceivably be after the game, immediately after the game, but anytime before you play again. Show that movie to the group. If you did your job right, players will be hooting and hollering about, "That person on the screen, that's me, and I handled it better," or, "That's how you do it, nitwit." The players essentially transpose themselves into the action and create stronger memories of the game by reliving it as a dramatization. Now, obviously, there's the worry that players will have seen the movie already and glide through the scenario. I think the James Bond 007 game handles this very well, as we've discussed. Most of its published adventure modules are based on Bond books or Bond films, stories we can't exactly call obscure, perhaps especially to people who have chosen to game in this world, probably are already James Bond fans. So in those adventures, they do change a few details, enough to keep things surprising. A villain's identity, just where a set piece might take place, an NPC's alliance. Not caring too much if it's familiar up front, but usually diverging more towards the climax. It, of course, also takes into account that while Bond's adventures are solo scenarios, here they will be played, or they might be played, by a small group of agents. And yet, movie night still works. In this case, players basically took turns being Bond. This one during a boat chase, this one during the fisticuffs, a third one wooing the girl. There's enough to go around. But most games don't do this overtly. The Doctor Who RPG source books that came out with the anniversary describe each serial in adventure terms, with what twists might be given to surprise players or the natural sequels or prequels that they might evoke. That's another take on it. In fact, you could end a scenario where a certain movie begins, then watch the follow-up, which might require too much railroading, arguably, but it depends on the time frame. Or your scenario might allude to what has gone before, something you only reveal to your players afterwards in front of the television. Here, you trade players' identification with world depth. They invest their imagination in the greater story being told and how they fit in it. Now, of course, you don't have to stay within licensed properties. If you're playing sword and sorcery, a western, superheroes, a military game, a samurai epic, space opera, horror investigators, whatever, you could safely steal a plot wholesale from a movie in that genre. If the players call you out on the familiarity, which frequently happens anyway, even when you're not emulating a movie or a show, you can say it was all part of the movie night experiment, see? And maybe your players haven't seen Red Sonja or Ride the High Country or Crisis on Earth 2 or The Dirty Dozen or Three Samurai or Ice Pirates, which sounds more like how my players play than does Star Wars, or The Conjuring, just to name check a movie in each of the genres I mentioned. They'll be interested in how their imagination and their strategy compares to the movie version, and they'll hopefully discover a cool movie. They might even learn enough about the genre's tropes to give a better and smarter performance next time around. So, who's ready to admit to stealing ideas for their games? That's what the comment section is for. Last episode of Let's Roll, we talked about GURPS steampunk and GURPS Vikings. My guest, Poutouillette, and I discussed in particular what makes a game punk. What is the punk after steampunk or in after any genre, cyberpunk, iron punk, whatever you want to use. So I want to read the one comment that really dissected this idea from Ian Fletcher. He says, great episode. I've been listening out of order to the chronicles of your cross-genre GURPS campaign, and have to say it sounds amazing. I tried something a little like this at one point, but never with the success you achieved. Hats off. Okay, then he gets into it. The discussion on punk is a good one to start up. I think the punk being representative of the counterculture nature of the protagonists within a genre. Cyberpunk involves counterculture heroes in a future setting incorporating advanced technology. If the word punk belongs in steampunk, is a topic I'm going to be gentle about. I don't really like the steampunk genre much myself, as it seems like it's more of a retro riff on cyberpunk than a genre itself. I prefer to label a lot of these as Victoriana, and that's where I personally put things like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in comics or Castle Falkenstein in RPGs. Cyberpunk, like steampunk, has the narrative genre elements and the aesthetic elements. When I see many steampunk enthusiasts or consume fiction with that label, I see it hitting many of the same narrative beats you've described. Walking around in Holmes, England, tailing Jack the Ripper, and seeing some of the future or exploitative technologies are all fascinating, and indeed, many of the protagonists are much more egalitarian than their age would permit, suggesting the punk part, but we also rarely play or write characters in the modern age who are as colonial, racist, or troubled as the humans of their era. So is this part actually punk or more a fashion of the present to ensure that our characters are sympathetic to the injustices of yesteryear? For example, if I'm playing a cowboy RPG, I'm not likely to make Tex the Indian Hunter. I might make a cowboy named Tex who's grown famous for repelling some raids from the natives, but Tex himself is unlikely to brag about his conquests against the Native Americans. For one, I'm not keen to be the colonial racist murderer in a game, and would likely leave the table if that became a recurring theme. But doing so doesn't make my Western game Westpunk. So, does introducing some modern and or fantastical technologies to a Western, such as in Deadlands, make it Westpunk? Has the meaning of punk in association with a genre morphed into a catchword to say extrapolative and alternative ideas within the overall aesthetic and style of the prefix genre? Perhaps it has? I think you've hit it on the nail, Ian. It really is. Cyberpunk was the thing, and then any other punk is basically taking some tropes from cyberpunk, but not the punk. They're taking the cyberware, they're taking the sort of technology. So in a steampunk universe, you might have a steam-powered cyber arm, or steam arm, or you might have some sort of ocular device over your eyes, which emulate cybernetic eyes. That's really what steampunk or any genre punk is about. But really, that's up to the GM and the players, if they want to punk it up somehow. But it's not necessarily built into the genre as we know it. Okay, well, the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page. I remind you, patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like this content, want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or a monthly donation. Let me also remind you that you can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com or on the Fire and Water Facebook page or Twitter, where we are FW Podcast. So until the next episode, let's roll.